The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on some basics you may have forgotten since middle school. Today, we're going behind the scenes of the Office of Presidential Correspondence, or OPC. The men and women who work in that office are in charge of sorting through all of the mail that is sent to a president. Jean Marie Laskus is the author of several books, including Concussion, and she spent many hours at the White House Office of Presidential Correspondence at the end of President Obama's tenure and got a firsthand look at how the arduous task of reading and sorting letters addressed to the president is handled. Hello there, Jean Marie.
Hi there.
How long has there been an official Office of Presidential Correspondence?
An official office dates back to the end of the 19th century with President McKinley. Prior to that, it was just sort of like George Washington got five letters a day. They didn't need an office. But by the time you move up through time, McKinley was getting 100 letters per day, and he needed help. And so he started this official office.
So this was called the OPC.
Correct. Office of Presidential Correspondence.
Then as the country is growing, postal service expanded, and then we have broadcast media. Did that change the interaction between the president and the public?
Oh, what happened when everything sort of exploded in terms of the conversation between constituents and the president was Roosevelt and his fireside chats. Remember that? He was inviting people to please, you know, tell me your stories, tell me your problems. And that's all they needed. I mean, people just flooded Roosevelt. That became the real origins, I think, of what we see today, or at least what we saw under Obama.
So how much mail was FDR getting?
Roosevelt was getting 500,000 letters a day.
Wow.
And it was, the bulk of it was so extreme that it was a fire hazard in the White House.
Any rules or statutes now about how presidents deal with mail? You know, do they have to keep track of it, keep records of it?
It's completely individual. For each president has their, you know, forms their own relationship with the mail. For example, Richard Nixon, he did not want to read any mail that was critical of him. And he had, you know, that was the official stance. Reagan, for example, he loved the kid mail, and he was known to stop in the mail room and, you know, he wanted to sort of personally look through that. That's the greatest mail.
Who doesn't love the kid mail?
Yeah, well, he loved it, and he took great pleasure in it. So that's the way it was, though. It was kind of like it was the president's taste that set the tone for what they would do with the mail.
And now with the Obama administration, you spent some time in there. And of course, we don't yet know how the Trump administration will be handling this. So this is a good reference for us. Tell us about what goes on in that office. First of all, how's it staffed? How many people work there?
So it's a large office, actually set over different locations around the White House grounds. 50 staffers, more than 300 volunteers coming in and out reading mail, and about 50 interns.
So how many messages was he getting a day?
Well, if you have to combine the paper mail, now there's email, and they also opened a Facebook Messenger app. So if you combine all that incoming, it was something like 200,000 messages a day.
Wow.
Huge numbers.
That is a huge number. How about the people who are working there now? Would they likely stay on from administration to administration?
No. You're a political appointee if you work in the correspondence office. So all the folks I was with, they had all worked for the campaign, actually, either one of his campaigns. And they were appointed by the then President Obama. And when his time was up, their time was up. So they all left.
Do historians look at this stuff? I mean, do they keep these as a record? That's hundreds and thousands of stacks of letters, you know, over a president's tenure.
It really depends on the focus of the president. I will tell you that correspondence from heads of state and, you know, the fancy people, that stuff you can find. But correspondence from just, you know, average Joe and Mary Sue from Montana writing about a question about their health care, all of that stuff has not been preserved until now. And that really goes to Obama's relationship with the mail. To him, it was really central to the way he felt he could connect. I mean, he set up, I want to read 10 letters a day at the very beginning of his administration. And that had never been done before. So this Office of Correspondence had to figure out how to do that and what were those 10 letters a day. Many of those he would answer in his own hand, actually.
How did they decide inside of the office, out of these tens of thousands of letters, to which 10 to show to the president?
So you imagine you've got this room, I mean, the paper mail room, for example, they called it the hard mail room. Just stacks and stacks and stacks of letters, all kinds. And interns going through them, coding them according to subject matter, and then pulling out anything they found was particularly moving. It was called sampling. You were encouraged to sample as many letters as you felt, you know, maybe the president should see this. Whatever you thought. Now, you're just an intern. What do you know, right? That's okay. That was the message. You know, you're a person just like these people are people, and just like the president is a person. Just be a person. So it would go through that process of screening, and then it would go to one person in the office, Fiona Reeves, who was the director of OPC. She would take that stack of samples, which could be about maybe 300 a day, and sit on the couch in her office and go through them one by one and choose which ones she thought were representative that the president should see.
You must have seen quite a few letters while you were there. What were people writing the president about?
I got to tell you, I sat in that mailroom and you become immediately addicted. You can't stop reading. It is so fascinating because there's nothing sorted. I mean, it's just mail. It comes in and it's so random. One person is writing about their dad who's in prison and they just want some help understanding the system. One person's sending in their medical bills to show how hard their life is. One person is writing in to praise the president for his decision on gay marriage. The gamut. And it's letter after letter after letter. I was surprised how many people wrote. You know, I thought it was like, who writes to the president? I didn't, you know, a lot of people.
Did you get a sense of whether a handwritten letter or an email is more effective at communicating? I mean, which made it to the 10 letters a day more often?
I think it was pretty evenly spread, although certainly the handwritten mail was the thing that got you emotionally, because there was so much extra stuff in a handwritten letter, you know. There was the penmanship. There was the choice of letterhead. There was the chance to put enclosures in there. That stuff, I think, really got maybe true. Well, it just was. It was an object, you know. The thing, though, that was wonderful about the email was it was immediate. So if there was an event going on, you know, the day before, like Trayvon Martin, you know, all of a sudden you're getting immediate feedback of what is like the pulse of the nation through the email. So they had their different roles.
How about the balance of kids' letters to adult letters in making those 10 letters a day?
The kid letters tended to, they were like incredible, just like adorable, like they would be. Fiona would talk about often using the kid letters because she would order the letters 1 through 10 that she thought the president should read them in this particular order. And often the number 10 would be a kid letter, you know, something that left him feeling, you know, left him smiling at the end of what could be a really depressing bunch of reading.
I wonder about the experience of reading them. You know, you're working in this office reading several of these. Sounds like they picked the moving ones every day. What was your impression of how they took it in?
They were, I mean, from the highest level of Fiona, she was like, I don't know, 25 when she started there, to the newest intern. Every one of them talked about being changed by this experience. To understand America through that lens, through these personal experiences, because that's what so many of them were just stories of their lives. And some of them were, you know, horrifying. People would send in photos of their children who had been killed in gun violence. You know, why are you writing to the president about this? You know what I mean? Like, it's usually a last resort, you know?
Did you ever see any of the president's responses to people?
I did. They were lovely. I mean, some of them were just, you know, he would handwrite on a card saying, thank you for your insights. You're right. I should be, you know, water skiing more. I mean, because people would say things like that to him, give him advice. But other ones were really supportive of, you know, I'm sorry what you and your family are going through. And you're right. We don't do enough. And here's what you can do in your community to help me help you.
Is there any evidence that these letters helped inform his decisions on policy?
Most definitely. I talked to him directly about that. And not only to him, but also to, for example, his speechwriters. Those letters were used. They called it the letter underground. You know, it was like a source. It was an unfiltered source. The speechwriter told me, you know, we will pull from, you know, here's this person suffering from something. And their health care is going to get taken away if we don't do something about this. I mean, it was that immediate.
Do we have any ideas about how the Trump administration is going to be handling mail?
The only thing we know for sure, the OPC also handled the comment line, which is a phone bank, basically, which was also near the mailroom, and that was staffed by interns and volunteers. And people would call in and OPC would take notes, basically. Anyway, that's been shut down. So if you call that number now, it leads to nowhere. I mean, I know they're just staffing up. I don't know what's happening to the mail.
What do you think the most important thing is that citizens, constituents should know about the Office of Presidential Correspondence?
I think that it exists, you know, and that it's the power of a letter. If you feel that you need to talk to your president, that is your right as an American, and write it down and send it in. I mean, prior to doing this research, I would have said, well, that's really kind of like writing to Santa Claus. Like, why would you do that? But now it's like, wait a second. No, that's it. That's why we have a president. I mean, he's there to serve the American people. So I feel like the power of a letter, That was the strongest message that came through to me.
Jean Marie Laskus, author of several books, including Concussion. She's also director of the writing program at the University of Pittsburgh and contributor to the New York Times. Jean Marie, thank you so much for our lesson today.
Thank you.
Now, since we spoke with Jean Marie, the Trump administration has reopened the White House comment line. The number is 202-465-1111. And while we don't know how the new staffers at the Office of Presidential Correspondence will sort through the mail, the address is public knowledge. So if you've been meaning to write a letter, you know where it goes. 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is the American dream to rise from obscurity through the ranks of musicians, writers, actors, and YouTube videos and make a hit. Industry experts, social scientists, entrepreneurs, and hacks have devoted their careers to figuring out what makes a hit.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW.
So what is the secret? And why do some products fail while others are massive successes? In a new book, Derek Thompson finds that blockbusters aren't generally all that original, and they don't fall from the sky, but are helped along by powerful, often secret, star maker networks. Derek is senior editor for The Atlantic and author of Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Derek, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
It's so great to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, in looking through America's cultural history, there's so many stories of talented people, you know, punching above their weight, getting discovered, turning the tide with the new it thing. And it feels good. The story plays well. Is it real?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when I went to write this book, I realized that I was writing what wanted to be an unsentimental book about a sentimental subject, when people have favorite movies and favorite songs, they often want to believe that those things are objectively the best. And they are maybe objectively the best for them. But in looking at these questions seriously as a scientist, you know, why do people like what they like? Why do some products succeed in cultural markets when others don't? What was really interesting is that all these psychologists and network theorists and sociologists had some answers that were somewhat dispiriting, maybe, for audiences, which is that there are lots of times when the so-called best product doesn't succeed, and the product that succeeds the best is really that with the most exposure.
Let's look at the ones that succeed, the ones that really grab our attention. You find there's something sneakily familiar in them, and it leads to one of the great characters we learn about in this book, Raymond Loewy, who really changed the game in industrial design. So first, just a little bit about him and some of the things that he came up with.
Sure. Raymond Loewy is the father of industrial design. He designed the modern locomotive, the modern car, the interior habitat of the first NASA spaceship, along with modern kitchens. He is an incredible figure, the Steve Jobs of the 1950s, essentially. And he had a theory for why people like what they like across all of these product categories. And it was called Maya, M-A-Y-A. Most advanced, yet acceptable. He had this theory that people are torn between neophilia, a love of new ideas, and neophobia, a fear of anything that's too new. And this is how he thought about designing all these products. To sell something surprising, you have to make it a little bit familiar. And to sell something familiar, you have to make it a little bit surprising. And so what I found in the course of writing this book, just as you alluded to, is that in many ways, this turns out to be one of the golden principles of pop culture. We love new songs that have familiar chord structures. We love new movies that are sequels, adaptations, and reboots of movies that we already know. Even in the political realm, we love hearing new metaphors and new stories and arguments that essentially uphold our prior biases. And so this interplay between the familiar and the surprising, the old and the new, is very much at the heart of what makes a hit a hit.
So this Maya principle, this is reinforced. There's a researcher, I think his name is Robert Zajonc, if I'm saying
Zajonc.
That. Zajonc, sorry. Sorry, Robert. But, you know, revealing this tension between familiarity and the challenge of the new. Give us an example of something blazingly new that didn't make it.
Oh, there are blazingly new things that don't make it all the time. You know, you think about at the beginning of, let's go way back, 150 years ago, to sort of the beginning of Impressionism. Nobody liked Impressionism who was in the artistic community in the 1870s and 80s. They thought it was absolutely horrifying. They thought it was disgusting. And it required an 1890s museum exhibit to publicly consecrate the Impressionist canon. We see this all the time, even with new forms of music and new stories, that sometimes we don't like something that is incredibly weird and strange. If our favorite kind of music is, you know, alternative pop, we don't like anything that's too adventurous and electronic. But what tends to happen, though, is that after a while, after being exposed to these ideas again and again and again, we become more familiar with them and we tend to like them more. And that's why this theory that Robert Zajonc came up with is called the mere exposure effect. It's one of the oldest theories in psychology. It essentially says that the mere exposure of any stimulus tends to bias respondents to it. So the more often that we eat Indian food, the more we tend to like Indian food. The more we listen to jazz music as children, the more we like jazz as adults. That there's this incredibly intimate relationship between familiarity and liking. And this is one of the reasons why exposure, advertising, marketing is so powerful. To like something, we have to see it.
That brings us to the other myth that gets shattered. Not just that commercial success is about a craving for originality, but the other that it is not really so much the product, but the invisible forces behind them, which sounds pretty nefarious. What is an example from the book that illustrates that kind of invisible network?
Yeah, so one of my favorite stories from the book is the story of Rock Around the Clock. Everybody knows this song. They can sing it. They can tap their foot to it. The song came out in 1954 as the B-side to a song called 13 Women. It comes out, and it's basically ignored. It sells about 70,000 copies, which at the time is not very impressive. And a lot of people just essentially throw it into the dustbin of history. The very next year, in 1955, Rock Around the Clock comes out as the first song in a movie called Blackboard Jungle. And after it comes out in this movie, it becomes this absolute wild craze. Students are blasting it from their college dorm rooms. Cities are trying to ban it because young people are playing the song so much. It becomes the first rock and roll song to ever hit number one in the Billboard Hot 100 and becomes the second best-selling song of all time. So if you're the sort of person that thinks that quality equals success, then what do you do with something like Rock Around the Clock? In 1954, it was a dud. In 1955, it became the second best-selling song of all time. So which one is it? And the answer is that distribution and luck is more important than quality and content. That the song came out in a movie at this particular moment in American history, and it suddenly blew up with this new network. And that is why it's a success and why we know it today.
What makes a hit? Those are among the questions behind Hitmakers, the science of popularity in an age of distraction. The book is by my guest, Derek Thompson, who is senior editor for The Atlantic. Still, though, when I hear that song, you know, we know about the history of rock and roll, that it comes out of the black blues, jump blues, R&B. So if, you know, Big Maybell or Big Joe Turner had a network behind it, it would have been them.
Well, so I think one thing that's incredibly important to point out, certainly with rock and roll, is that it was mainstreamed by white artists. The people who owned the means of distribution, whether it was radio or recorded music or the movies in this case, were often biased against the black artists who were clearly the godfathers of R&B. And so, unfortunately for the history of rock and roll, certainly, it required people who owned the means of distribution to mainstream this sound. And then once it was mainstreamed, you tended to see more people experimenting with it and more people sort of following on and jumping on the sound. This is how we got Elvis. This is how people started to play with Elvis's music, which eventually got us to the 1960s and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. But it did. It required this moment of public consecration. Without Blackboard Jungle, the rock and roll revolution would not have happened the way that it happened. Distribution created culture.
Well, and also repetition creates culture, or at least reinforces it. You know, the four chord progression in rock and roll. You kicked off Elvis, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones. And this also works for speechwriters. This also works for novelists. So what happens here? We get to this point where something explodes and then it's copycats that take them on?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's a couple of really interesting things about repetition, particularly in music. You know, I talked to this musicologist, Diana Deutsch, out in California, who works with all of these musical illusions. And one of the musical illusions that she's most famous for discovering is what's called the speech-to-song illusion, which is this idea that you take almost any spoken sentence and you start repeating it again, start repeating it again, start repeating it again, start repeating it again, and the brain starts to hear rhythm and music. They start to hear da-da-da-da-da-dun, da-da-da-da-da-dun. And so what musicologists have realized is that repetition in many ways is the God particle of music. It is the thing that distinguishes mere cacophonous sound from music. And so, as you alluded to, you know, this is an incredibly important principle in speech writing as well. Almost every ancient Greek rhetorical device is essentially an example of repetition. There is anaphora, which is repetition at the beginning of a sentence. We shall fight them on the beaches. We shall fight them on the landing grounds. Winston Churchill. Most famously, there is something called antimetaboly, which is an A-B-B-A structure. ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Or Hillary Clinton, human rights are women's rights and women's rights are human rights. And so what was so fun in the writing of this book is seeing how seemingly far-flung ideas in culture are actually connected by this invisible string, that the songwriters and the speechwriters are actually implicitly using the same formula, of repetition with sly variety in order to create catchy sounds in both pop music and speeches.
In a more cynical view, that politicians repeat something over and over again until it becomes true, right? Because we're somehow familiarized with it. So tell us how that works in an age of when we're looking at, you know, viral news, confirmation bias. We look for the things that are familiar to us and that we can agree with to believe.
Yes, this is such an important question. And constantly in the book, what I'm trying to do is elevate some of these stories about media and entertainment and show that there are, you know, capital S serious implications for culture and even for politics. So as you said, if it is true psychologically that when we hear things repeated in sing-songy ways, we're more likely to believe them, that's actually an incredibly dangerous civic principle. It's a very dangerous idea to hear that if we hear something repeated over and over and over again, the brain starts to conflate familiarity with fact. There was this fascinating study, one of my favorite studies from the book, pointed out that they had researchers give people a bunch of phrases like shark cartilage helps with arthritis. And they would repeat these things over and over to both young and old participants in a study. And then in the study, they would say, you know, this is a myth. Shark cartilage does not help arthritis, but they would keep repeating the sentence. And so what they found, rather dispiritingly, is that when they called these people back to the lab a few weeks later, the young people would be able to separate the truth from the myth. But for older people whose implicit and explicit memories were a little bit more jumbled, they found that old people actually were much more likely to say, yes, shark cartilage really does help with arthritis. So the brute force of repetition familiarize this connection between shark cartilage and arthritis, and some participants said, yeah, that statement feels right. It feels familiar, so it's probably correct. So as you can see, there's this incredibly dark insinuation between familiarity and fact, which I think has really dangerous implications for politics, because it suggests that, for example, if you're a television network, you have the power to repeat with brute repetition the same ideas over and over and over again, even if they're not true. And so the television channel, the force of distribution, has the power to dictate truth through mere repetition.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And we're continuing our conversation about what makes a hit, with Derek Thompson. He's senior editor for The Atlantic and author of Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Before the break, we talked about some of the origin stories of hits and how established distribution networks made them possible. In the present, people have access to networks without gatekeepers. So a woman with a Chewbacca mask can share a video of herself laughing in a minivan that can be seen and shared all over the globe after she posts it online. So, Derek, how does that work now? How does a Twilight fan fiction author write a book like 50 Shades of Grey and turn it into a best-selling franchise, movie deal and all, without a traditional publisher?
Right, right. And this is what's really interesting. And this is one of the things I found most fascinating, is that distribution power used to be really scarce. It was the gatekeepers that had total power over it. But now, look what's happened in music. You used to have to push a song's popularity through scarce radio channels. But today, everything is radio. Facebook is radio. Twitter is radio. A random Spotify playlist that has 1,000 or 50,000 followers, that's radio too. And so what you can see is that the hits, which used to be dictated top down by tastemakers, are now much more likely to go bottom up. It's about how people are following the large groups that they can see in their own networks. So I tell the story of 50 Shades of Grey and how that particular book went viral. And one of my theories is that it didn't quite go viral in the way that most of us think. 50 Shades of Grey was written in a fan fiction network, fanfiction.net. The author, E.L. James, had millions of readers on this website that the publishers couldn't see. So when she came out with this book, when she finally took all of her digital fan fiction writings of Twilight, which were 50 Shades of Grey, and she published them for the first time as an ebook, she brought this massive, obscure, dark crowd with her from this online group. And so what you can see essentially is that she had built, through her own little networks, essentially a broadcast. She had amassed this enormous audience, but the old-fashioned broadcasters couldn't see it. And so it exploded in a way that was surprising to them, to the publishers, but wouldn't have been surprising to anybody who could actually see the vast power that she had on fanfiction.net. So I don't think that the power of broadcasting has changed. I think it has just downshifted. It used to be monopolized by publishers and movie studios and music labels, and now everybody has the power to build their own broadcast.
Well, and you mentioned movie studios, and earlier you talked about how sequels, you know, in the book you mentioned 15 highest grossing films of the past 16 years are sequels or adaptations of very well-known books. But we love it, don't we, still, when something does seem to pop out of nowhere and grab us? I'm thinking of, you know, Slumdog Millionaire, right? Mm-hmm. You know, a sort of movie that kind of comes out of nowhere and grabs us. Does that perpetuate the myth that you try and correct in this book?
I do think that we are fascinated by underdog stories. We're, of course, fascinated by exceptions to rules, right? My Big Fat Greek Wedding, where the heck did that come from? But I also think that if you look underneath the hood, a lot of these surprise stories just actually aren't that surprising. So, for example, something like Slumdog Millionaire, it was a smaller budget movie, but it was also made by a famous director and had a lot of traditional marketing behind it. And so it was, of course, going to be on the radar of Oscar hopefuls and Oscar voters. I think of another movie that is kind of a surprise hit and absolutely brilliantly original in its own way, something like Moonlight, the Oscar-nominated Moonlight from 2016. On the one hand, this is an incredibly brave and original and purposely strange movie. The art direction is almost more like poetry. It deals with homosexuality and black men in a way that not a lot of mainstream movies have. But then I think about the structure of the film. It's very clearly divided into three chapters. And what's so interesting is that the classic structure of romance and even romantic comedies is a three-structure play, essentially. In the first act, the love interests meet and try to figure each other out. In the second act of this structure, the love interests come together and then at the very end of the second act are sort of torn apart for some reason. And then they reunite in the third act, and that's what gives the audience that beautiful catharsis, right? That is how romantic comedies almost always are shaped.
Mm-hmm.
And if you step back and think about it, that's exactly how Moonlight is shaped too. In the first act, they come together. In the second act, they fall apart. And in the third act, they come together again. And so what is absolutely and unquestionably this brave and original and ingenious film nonetheless uses extremely familiar archetypes in order to ground the audience in the experience and make the final catharsis hit harder. So again, I think that under the hood of a lot of these seemingly purely original productions and artworks is actually a very canny and sneaky familiarity, which is precisely what people want across the pop culture landscapes.
Derek, in this book, you give us the science, economics, you know, some theories, but is there still some magic to what makes a hit, some random quality that no one can predict?
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, the way that I have talked about this book sometimes is to say just because you know some of the science doesn't mean that you can predict all of the outcomes. So let's think a little bit about another subject where this is true, the weather. We know now, we used to think that the sun rose because of gods and the rain fell because the gods were crying. Now we know how clouds form. We know why rain falls. We know when rain freezes. We know why the sun rises and why it sets. But at the same time, even the wisest meteorologist in the world cannot predict what the weather is going to be in your zip code in 3 weeks. It's impossible because weather is chaotic, and it's impossible to predict such chaotic outcomes too far in advance. And what I would say is that cultural markets are chaotic too. Incredibly chaotic. People are constantly watching each other to figure out what should they download next, what should they like, what's familiar, what's good. And so this constant social influence creates chaotic markets in culture, just like the weather. So, of course, some people have turned to me with this book and they've said, well, all right, you've written the book about what makes a hit, give me the formula. Give me the, you know, four variable formula for making a hit. And what I tell them is this: look, the book has a 7-word thesis. Familiarity beats originality, and distribution beats content. And I have examples where I can unpack that idea. But at the end of the day, codes are for garages. 1986, enter, and the garage opens. But culture is not a garage. You can't just punch in a code and expect an inevitable outcome. It's more complicated than that. What's familiar is constantly changing. Where the distribution lives is constantly changing. What people like is constantly evolving because of fashion and backlash. And so the principles are important. But just because you know the principles doesn't make you an infallible creator of hits.
Derek Thompson, senior editor for The Atlantic and author now of Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
For more on the book, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Broke for Free, Persona La Ave, and David Seste. Loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. So stay in touch with us, and we will be back with you tomorrow too here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.